This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And if you need help bringing out the best in your pet's behavior, then give us a call right now. Our number is 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. As always, we have another special topic to share. And what will we be talking about this time, Patricia?
Well, we all know that ravens are famous for what looks like intelligent, almost strategic behavior.
Right.
One of my favorite examples is biologists observe ravens tossing rocks at people who are trying to ban the young in the nest. I even saw ravens kicking snow off telephone poles onto a man walking underneath. And whenever it would hit his head and he'd look up in surprise, all the ravens would go, caw, 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 almost as if they were laughing. But here's the question. How smart are they really? Well, we're going to talk about that a little later on in the show.
And we'll also welcome the author of a book called Sensuous Seas to talk about the mating habits of certain species of sea life. You know, some of these animals have more exciting love lives than you might imagine.
I'm all ears.
Well, we'll hear more about that a little later on in the show. But for now, we're ready to take some more calls. And let's take a call. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, I'm Dawn, and I'm calling from Arlington, Tennessee.
Dawn, thank you very much for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, my question is about our German Shepherd dog. He is about 3 years old. Very well-trained, obedient gentleman. Can't even beg him and coax him to get him on the bed. He is very good, but he has a very strange behavior. It is called a sniffle snaffle, and that's the technical term, of course.
The scientific term.
Well, this is, can I just kind of describe it? Because that's the only way to...
Please do.
Okay. My little one is around 5, and she... Anytime she hurts herself and falls down and starts to cry or gets upset in any way, if I hold her or when she comes to me, he just gets very excited. Now, not excited like alert, oh, I'm, you know, watching out for somebody outside. Like just twitter-pated, just, just walking around her. And he starts going around us in circles. And then he starts snuffling her up like... a mama dog, whenever they have their babies,
yeah.
And she's licking them and snuffling them, and you're thinking, you don't have to be so rough. It's a tiny baby. But you leave her alone because apparently she knows what she's doing. He starts doing that. And then if it gets going some more, like I guess if he likes what he smells, he might start a little flea biting. You know how they kind of nip at their own skin?
I do.
Well, then I'll do that. And he has gotten her skin one time, but definitely unintentional, has gotten her a piece of clothing of mine. I really don't know what to say other than sniffle snaffling and twitter-pated.
I love your terms, first of all. I think you should create...
I am college educated, but we didn't learn those at Oklahoma State.
Well, I think we should add them to the lexicon. I think as a certified applied animal behaviorist, I think we should have a new dictionary. And I think sniffle snaffle should be at the head.
Right at the head.
And like, so, we should put that in Wikipedia for sure.
There you go. Now, here's the fun part of the sniffle snaffle is what you're describing is very well known to people who know dog behaviors. That little flea biting, that little what they're doing is it's a grooming behavior, basically, in which they're moving the front teeth together in little tiny little movements, and they use it to groom other individuals. It's very friendly, it's very benevolent, but I can see how if the dog is also, being a pretty big one, really excited and highly aroused, then it might be a little scary. And also it sounds like there's a few objects going in between those little teeth, you know, that are motivated to be benevolent but could indeed sort of turn into trouble. So here's what I do. I think the main thing to work on is the dog's arousal level. So here's what I do is I would teach an incompatible behavior. So say your daughter... You pick her up, for example. This is an easy one to control. What I want you to do is I want to teach your shepherd that there's a cue for sitting down. You know,
we all
usually teach dogs to sit down to the cue of our voice. We say sit or we use a hand signal, right? That's the cue. But I want you to teach your shepherd a different cue. And that cue is when you pick your daughter up 2 inches off the ground, your dog's supposed to sit. Because if he does, you throw the ball or you give him a treat or you give him a big chest rub. Go boy, go boy. And the trick is you're not going to ask him to do, you're not going to ask him to sit and then pick your daughter up and then sort of twirl her around. That's just not going to work. You're going to do it very differently. You're going to put your arms under your little girl's armpits, you know, like you're going to pick her up, and you're going to turn and look at your dog, and you're going to say, sit. And the microsecond that shepherd sits, you're going to reward him, give him a reinforcement, something he really, really likes. And then you're going to take your hands away from your little girl. You're going to do that a whole bunch of times in a row. Don't pick her all the way up. Just do this step by step. But somewhere in this process, maybe time 5 or 6 or 7, you're not going to say sit. You're going to do the exact same thing. Put your hands on your daughter as if to pick her up. Pause. Look at your dog. And you're going to wait for your dog to sit on his own. You dropped out the sit cue. And you're going to teach him, oh, if I sit to you putting your hands on your daughter, then I get reinforced. I get it. So you can transfer the cue. So then the trick is first you're going to pick her up just like an inch, and then it's going to be 3 inches, and then it's going to be all the way. Staying quiet, not getting really loud and excited. I want you to teach the dog to sit anytime there's kind of arousal and excitement. And if he learns to contain himself and monitor his own emotions, then good things will happen. Does that all make sense?
Perfect sense. Good. And very doable. He loves to work, so any challenges that come his way, he's always ready for. And that is a perfect answer to this in any situation.
That's
because
right.
As he learns, the more, oh, that's perfect. The more excited things get around him, the more subdued he will become.
Exactly.
And that is perfect when you weigh 115 pounds and there's rugrats everywhere.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so let us know how it goes.
Yelling rugrats.
Right.
Covered in chocolate. Yes. So that's great. Thank you.
All right, Dawn. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, we received an email from Paul in Menasha, Wisconsin. And Paul has the following question for you. It's an interesting one, I think. Our family has overwintered 2 painted turtles that were dug up at a road repair site last fall. We've discovered they perform a ritual swim. The choreography involves the turtles facing each other. They circle each other then with their necks extended. Then the necks are retracted and the front legs come forward with palms out and
Ooh.
They rapidly quiver.
Oh, my goodness. I'm quivering just hearing this.
Do you have any ideas as to what might be communicated here between these two?
I wonder if this is courtship behavior. You know, I'm
kind of sounds
as,
like it, doesn't
as
it?
As people who know the show know well, I'm not a turtle behavior expert. But boy, does that sound like courtship behavior to me. I will go look it up. Mm-hmm. And we can talk more about it. Maybe that might be a fun topic sometime to talk about.
And maybe our guest today, Gene Kaplan, might be able to tell us what's going on, too.
That's right.
The
That's right.
Seas
Author
guide.
Of The Sensuous Seas. It sounds very much to me like courtship behavior. The two, it's possibly aggressive also. I mean, that's another possibility. That could be some kind of a threat display. So the three possibilities are a threat display between, say, 2 territorial individuals of the same sex, same species, a courtship display, or sometimes with quivering, you see a lot of young animals quivering when they're begging. But then normally you would expect to see one doing it from an older individual.
Yeah.
So I put my money on one of the first two.
I think you might well be right.
Yeah, we'll go do some research on that.
And if people want to email us, how do they do that?
Oh, it's easy. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And if you'd like to call us, here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Katie from Eau Claire, Wisconsin.
Thanks for calling, Katie. What's on your mind?
I recently got a cat from my aunt, and it's an 8-year-old male. And we already have a 6-year-old female cat and a 13-year-old Labrador retriever.
Okay.
And we've had the new cat for about a month and a half, and he will not come out from under the bed. We've given him a room of his own where the dog can't get at him, and we've tried just about everything they can think of, but he just seems terrified. When I go into the room to sleep at night, he'll actually come up and get under the covers with me.
Oh, good.
And sleep with me, but as soon as he knows I'm awake, he goes right back under the bed.
Oh,
I'm really confused about, it seems like he wants to be friendly and he wants companionship, but he's just too afraid. And I just, I want to know what I can do to make him more comfortable.
Yeah.
You're confused and he's confused, too.
Mm-hmm.
And he's terrified. And you know, the phrase scaredy cat has a real basis. There's a certain personality type in cats. And we know from research that some of it is genetically mediated. But when you combine it with a lack of a lot of socialization, a lot of varied experiences as a young kitten, if you combine those two things, you can get these super, super fearful shy cats. And they're the ones who don't handle change very well. So one of the things to do with a cat like this is to not push it. Every time you try and force some kind of interaction, you're going to scare them a little bit more. So I love that this cat is coming up and sleeping while you're being really quiet and sort of uninteractive. What you might want to try doing is getting up in the bed and just getting really quiet, but have something wonderful sort of close to you, like little pieces of chicken or turkey or something that this cat really loves. And try and figure out what when you put food in the room and leave him alone, what's gone fastest, you know. So mm-hmm. You can start luring the cat up a little bit when you're not completely sound asleep. But resist the urge to reach out and pet. Resist the urge to try and make this work. Let the cat initiate the interaction on his own. Sometimes it just takes a little bit longer. Some cats are so slow. We've talked about this a lot before. To adapt to a new circumstance, the standard time for two cats to get along, for example, is 2 months. Larry's stray cat that Renee and Larry took in took 6 months to get along with his other cat. So it might just need a little bit more time. Now, another thing, though, you might want to think about is talking to a certified applied behaviorist or a veterinary behaviorist would be ideal, because in some situations it might be a good idea to use some kind of safe psychotropic medicine, some kind of drug that just relieves a certain amount of this anxiety. And there are people who are well acquainted with using these kind of medications. Some vets are, some vets aren't. So I think the question would be to your vet, are you familiar with using anti-anxiety medications in cats? And if not, then who could you refer me to? So that's something else to think about. But I think most important is tremendous amount of patience and letting the cat go at his own speed, always protecting him from the other cat and the dog. Just leave him in that room for a while. Several more months is just fine.
And good luck.
Yeah, good luck.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks very much for calling, Katie. Appreciate it. And if you'd like to join in, the number to call is 1-800-462-7413. Coming up next, find out whether being called a bird brain is actually an insult or a compliment. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers a variety of information, including online archives of the show, pet tips, Patricia's dog training books, and the opportunity to submit email questions. The website is callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And Tricia, ravens of the North Woods are famous for what looks like, anyway, intelligent, strategic behavior. How smart are they?
Well, you know, a biologist named Baron Heinrich has been studying this topic for years, and he is suggesting that these birds should redefine what we mean when we say bird brain.
Okay. Well, what's he discovered so far?
Well, one of his most famous experiments involved tying a piece of food up with a string, okay? He tied this food to a wooden perch and let it sort of hung down quite a long ways underneath this perch. So it was out of the raven's reach. And what he found was that when you put an adult raven on this perch, one of the food, the raven solved the problem, get this, by reaching down with their beak and pulling the string up a few inches and then stepping on the string that they'd pulled up with one foot to sort of hold it up there.
Oh boy.
So raising the food up like 2 inches and then pulling some more string up and then putting their food on that to hold it there and continuing that until they got the food up. And one of the most amazing things about this is rather than figuring this out by trial and error, they would just study this food and string for as much as 3 to 4 minutes. Just look at it. And then they would instantly solve it as if by insight.
That is incredible. And Heinrich has some new research out, doesn't he? What's that all about?
He does. Heinrich and one of his colleagues, Thomas Bugnar, set up this series of experiments to see if ravens would change their behavior based on the knowledge that other ravens were watching them. So what they did is one of the ravens was allowed to hide food. It was taken into a room. There are a lot of places to hide or cache food, which is something ravens do all the time. But the kick is that there were two other ravens that were allowed to watch. And the hider knew, could see, that the other ravens were watching. One watcher could see clearly where the food was being hidden. The other watcher's view was obstructed by a curtain. So the hider knew that there were two individuals watching and that one could see, potentially anyway, and one couldn't. So the question was, what was this raven going to do if he had the knowledge that other ravens were watching and one was, quote, knowledgeable about where the food was?
All right.
And one wasn't. So if ravens have something called theory of mind, which is an understanding of what might be in the minds of others, then you would expect this raven to behave differently when released into this enclosure with the other ravens.
Theory of mind. We talked about that on the show before, I think, with chimps. What did they find with regards to ravens?
Well, they found that the hiding raven, immediately went to the hidden food and ate it right away if the, quote, knowledgeable bird was there. So if the bird who had an unobstructed view was released into this closure with the hider, apparently understanding that bird knew where the food was, went to get it first. But if it was released with the other raven, the one whose view was obstructed, the ravens, rather than going to the hidden food, just sort of hung out, just sort of
sauntered around a little bit.
Some little raven equivalent of whistling Dixie. And so, in other words, what this suggests is that ravens are able to put themselves in the place of another individual, imagine what they know, and then predict their behavior based on that.
So that does put a new positive spin on the term bird brain.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, if you want to learn more about this experiment, we'll have some information and links posted for you at callingallpets.org. And if you have an animal behavior question you'd like to ask us, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. And you know what? Some people have done that. Let's go to the phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, I'm Erin, and I'm in Alexandria.
Alexandria, Virginia, I assume?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
What can we do for you?
I am looking to get some sort of pet, and I work full-time, and I live by myself, so I would like a smaller pet. I live in a studio apartment, but I was thinking maybe two birds. They could keep each other company, but I wanted something quiet so that my neighbors wouldn't be disturbed if, you know, they were making
mm-hmm.
noise.
Sure.
And I kind of wanted to have a pet that had a little bit of a personality.
So not a fish.
Not a fish. I've had fish. They're fish.
Well, I'm standing up for fish here.
I knew you were going to do that. I baited you, so to speak.
And it worked, too. Darn it. I'm putty in your hands, Mueller. It worked. I have to say that fish are not exactly the warm and cuddly pet that many of us. And that was actually one of my questions is do you like cuddly?
I guess I like interactive.
Okay.
Not necessarily cuddly.
Okay.
I don't think I'm ready for a dog because they're a little more than I can handle.
Yeah, and good for you for being aware that dogs are sort of like having 40% of a child, basically.
Yeah. But birds are a lot of fun.
Yeah, and here's some ideas for you. There are some wonderful birds out there who are very interactive and very intelligent. But there are some species who are indeed very noisy. A conure comes to mind. It's a species of small parrot. Stay mm-hmm. away from the conures, no matter what anybody tells you. Just a-ooga, dive. Don't get a conure. They're quite noisy. But some of the other birds, parakeets, they're chirpy, but they're not mm-hmm. going to keep your neighbors awake. So that's one possibility. Cockatiels can be tremendous fun for sort of new avian pet owners. Those are the two that most come to mind are parakeets or cockatiels.
Would two be happier together, do you think, than one?
There's definitely an advantage of having two if they are well matched, if they get along. Now, sometimes people will get another one in hopes of entertaining the first one, and then they end up in sort of the cockatiel wars or something like that. So I would get them together, make sure they're a matched pair. But yeah, I think in general, as long as they're well matched and get along, I think two is a great idea. So that's one possibility. The other two things that come to mind are a house rabbit,
mm-hmm.
and they have very different personalities, can be very interactive, and yet you can leave a rabbit in a cage all day long feeling reasonably comfortable, as long as when you come home you're going to give that rabbit time out running around the house. You can indeed house train a rabbit. And
yes.
the other thing that comes to mind is a ferret,
mm-hmm.
who, highly interactive, very intelligent, quiet, are definitely not going to be making a lot of noise. This is not a first-time pet for people. Ferrets are small weasels. They're predators. They're extremely intelligent. They can bite. But they're one of the most – watching ferrets play is one of the most joyful, amazingly wonderful experiences known to mankind. So those are the three groups I would sort of think about. And then there's always the rat. My favorite quiet, easy care, interactive, intelligent pets is a rat. Just because they don't have hair on their tail, don't hold it against them. It's not their fault. Get little implants, little hair implants on the back of their tails. Well, let us know what happens.
Thanks, Sarah.
Well, thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Appreciate the call. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call if you'd like to join in. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, Larry and Patricia. How are you doing?
Good. Who are we speaking with?
This is Steve from Brown Deer, Wisconsin.
Steve, thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I have two very affectionate cats. They're both female, and they're both house cats that have never been outside. And I'm doing a bathroom remodel right now, and one of them got out the window when I left it open. So that in itself wasn't too big of a problem, but I put her down, and the other cat saw me carry her in, and about 15 minutes later, I heard a racket in the basement, and it sounded like they were going to kill each other.
Yep.
And I thought, what in the world is going on? I went down there, was able to separate them, and Lincoln, the one that's always a little more bold, had Sherman, the one that was outside. She chased her up into the ceiling, which is where Sherman always hides anyway. So, and she wouldn't let her out, and it's been a few days now, and she still doesn't let her out.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, and she just, they growl at each other, they hiss at each other, and these are two cats that have slept on top of each other.
Best friends.
Every day, they groom each other and everything, so I can't figure out what she got into that would make Lincoln freak out so much.
This is regrettably
a common
experience, I regret to say, and so when you started telling me the story, we both knew where it was going.
Oh, no.
I was making little attack actions to Larry with my hands.
Was nodding with a rueful smile on
my face. Yeah, it's so frustrating, isn't it? It's just really painful to see when these best buddies, and what seems to happen with cats, we don't really understand it because it doesn't happen with dogs, is that you get two cats who are best buddies, and then one either gets outside, sees another one outside. Somehow, it's about, what I can tell you is the basis is smell. The cat came back, and it smelled wrong. And it smelled like an unfamiliar cat. And basically, for some reason, the cat who stayed inside decided the cat who had been outside had morphed into an unfamiliar stray intruder.
Oh.
Keep in mind that their vision is very, very poor, and a lot of their tremendous amount of their contact with each other is about smell. So basically, as best we can tell, the cat who stayed inside thinks that you lost the other cat and you brought a new cat in.
Oh, okay.
And so that's how you need to treat it. The first thing I do is I would take which one is initiating the aggression right now?
Lincoln.
Lincoln. Take Lincoln out of that room. Put Lincoln somewhere else. You've got to get the poor other cat out of the ceiling, right? So take Lincoln out, put Lincoln somewhere else, and then get the other cat out. And then you're going to need to treat it as if they were completely unfamiliar cats.
Right.
So it's the old standard routine is you keep them in separate rooms. You start exchanging their smells so they get used to each other's smells. I would seriously consider using Feel Away, the pheromone that can help soothe some cats. It's based on some good biology. It's not sort of woo-woo.
Okay.
And you plug it into a wall.
You can plug it into a wall. You can spray certain areas with it. I would highly suggest that. And basically treat it like two unfamiliar cats. Don't let them get in any contact until you can alternate their scents and let them smell each other. It's like a towel one has been on, or they look completely comfortable, and then let them sniff noses under a door. And once that seems fine, then you can start letting them back together again. But it might be months.
Okay.
That's the bad news. The good news is that I've had a lot of clients who ended up with their cats right back to being good buddies again.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was outside all of 15, 20, maybe a half an hour.
Isn't that amazing?
That's all it takes. Yeah. Unfortunately. Thanks, Steve. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. 1-800-462-7413, our number to call. Coming up next, sea creatures gone wild. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers online archives of the show, pet tips contributed by other listeners, and a complete list of guests featured on the program. Our website is callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Also, the radio store provides a selection of books and training guides featuring advice to deal with multi-dog households and leaving pets home alone. Information and ordering at 800-747-7444. That's 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And this week we welcome Eugene Kaplan to the program. Eugene is a professor emeritus at Hofstra University and the author of several books and field guides related to marine biology. And his latest book is titled Sensuous Seas. Tales of a Marine Biologist. And he joins us today to talk about it. Eugene Kaplan, welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us.
Hello.
It's great to have you here. Why did you decide to write about this subject matter?
Well, I wrote about it because I found that my students were falling asleep, and it upset me, so I decided to wake them up at the beginning of each lecture. So I included a lot of spicy stories in the book that I had used to keep my students awake.
Sex sells, huh?
Yes, it does. Even in the classroom.
I think you're right about that. Well, we talk about pheromones quite a bit on this show regarding humans, cats and dogs. Do sea creatures have pheromones too?
Well, it's the kind of thing that sea animals use because it's much easier for the pheromones to be transmitted in the water. So they invariably use pheromones to communicate with each other in the realm of sexual behavior.
So the pheromones, or maybe describe their effect on other animals.
Well, in the case of female squids, the female releases these pheromones in very minute quantities, maybe a few molecules, and the male has the apparatus to receive those few molecules, and a large number of males congregate around the female. And that causes her to become deluged with affectionate males. And so she jets away and tries to escape from them using a burst of black ink. And then finally she becomes receptive, and a lot of the males begin to copulate with the female, and each male feels necessary to fight with the other males to protect his sperm. And if he loses, another male, the winning male, squirts water into the mantle of the female to remove the sperms. This kind of process occurs in the ocean all the time. Pheromones are used to coordinate sexual activity among organisms that randomly release their sexual products, their gametes.
It's a lot different when you're an internal fertilizer like humans, right, compared to ones who just sort of spread their spread their gametes to the water, as it were. You know, I'd love to hear you talk about another way that squid and octopi communicate, and I think also in mating, which is the change of color.
Yes, in the case of the squid, there is a gorgeous mating ritual whereupon the courting male turns a variety of different colors because these animals have their color system called chromatophores connected to the nervous system, which is unusual because animals like chameleons use hormones to change their color, and it takes a long time. But squids and octopods can change their color very, very quickly. And so there is this display where color washes over the courting male, and purple and blue and clear colors go up and down his body. The female kind of blushes. She has these pink and other purple colors. So when the ritual reaches its climax, both of them turn a deep purple color, and then that signifies the receptivity of the female.
This must be beautiful. Have you been in the water and watched this? It must be gorgeous.
Well, there is a video of that phenomenon that I watch over and over again. not to be prurient, but to be aesthetic.
Oh, it does sound wonderful. What are some other ways sea creatures attract mates?
Well, in addition to the pheromones, which is the major function, because these animals don't think. They just respond to stimuli. In the case of the super male parrotfish, it is attracted to a female, but it doesn't know what to do because the super male was originally a female that turned into a ferocious, huge male, which is different from the other males in the school. And it tries to perform a mating ritual, but it's not good at it because it really basically is a female and it can't do the male's role. So it often doesn't work.
Aren't there a lot of fish that start as males and turn into females, or start as females and turn into males? Isn't that relatively common?
Yes. It often happens that females are much larger than males because they have to carry a heavy burden. Females often have very tiny males. In some cases, the males are pimples on the female's reproductive organs.
You said it, I didn't.
Well, we can't have any application to humans.
Right.
Understood. Talk about sea hares. What are sea hares and what makes their love life so exciting?
Sea hares are like giant snails that have lost the shell. They're very highly evolved, and they have the vestiges of the shell as little pieces of chalk, calcium carbonate, inside of their mantle, their bodies. This allows them to move relatively quickly, and they have a very odd mating activity. The females, which are also male, because they're hermaphroditic, the females release pheromones, which causes the males to become attracted to them. But the males are actually females in part. So what happens is the sea hares in this party where the males and females are attracted to each other, they line up in a row so that the male behind the first female mates with her, and the next male female mates with the successor, and they're in a row. But the problem is that the first sea hare, that is a female, can't mate with the male because she's at the head of the line. So they resolve the problem by forming a circle.
Oh, man.
I've laughed when I read that in
your
book.
What an image.
It is a great image, isn't it?
So how many sea hares can be connected to each other in this
circle,
this amazing circle of love? Thank you, Larry.
Well, imagine 12 of them. They are very big, and they could be a foot long.
Wow.
And if you pick them up, they feel like a mass of jello. But the trick is that if you squeeze them lightly, they'll release a purple dye. And in my classes, we cause the kids in the class to squeeze the sea hares to get that purple dye on their hands, in which case they're encouraged to put their hands on their white T-shirt, and that leaves a purple stain of, in the shape of a hand. And that means that you belong to the Sea Hare Lovers Club. And if you meet anybody, you have to hug that person if he's wearing this T-shirt with the purple hand on it.
We will all keep our eyes peeled now. I love it.
Well, you've been teaching for a long time and have had a lot of experiences. What's your most one of your most interesting experiences outside of what we've talked about here in terms of the animals in the sea?
Well, we have an annual ritual. It's called the Great Jade Green Octopus Hunt. And we go out at night to find the octopods because they are nocturnal. So one time we were out there searching for the octopods in the shallows. It was pitch black except for lightning in the background, and it was a very scary kind of thing. So the students found an octopus glowing in the light of their flashlights, and they got very excited, and they grabbed the octopus and broke off one of its arms. And my colleague, who had just come back from Japan, saw this raw octopus arm and popped it into his mouth because he had just come from Japan and they eat raw octopus arms all the time. But he didn't realize that the octopus that you get in Japan has been marinated in something like vinegar and it's dead. He popped this into his mouth, and there was a reflex that the arm had whereupon the suckers stuck to his throat.
Oh, no.
And he's a huge man, and he was standing there gasping in water that was up to his knees and pointing to his throat, and the octopus tentacle had adhered to his throat. And everybody stood around not knowing what to do. Even if you took a first aid course, they don't cover the subject of removing octopus tentacles from your throat.
I don't remember that lesson, no. What happened?
So he pulled the octopus tentacle out of his throat finally, and that caused a remarkable memory.
That's understatement.
I think so.
I'll bet. Well, speaking of memories, what lesson would you say you're trying to communicate to your students when you teach?
Well, the point is I established this marine laboratory to give students the opportunity to go out into the field and see what I'm talking about, what I'm droning on interminably about, the reality of it. And the students are assigned what appears to them as an impossible task. They have to learn a vast, vast amount of material in 10 or 12 days, and then there's a final. So the main lesson that they get from this is that they can do the impossible, and that is something that stays with them for the rest of their lives, no matter when they forget the names of the scientific organisms or the details of the ecology that they had to memorize for the exam. So that's the message that I convey, that a person can do the impossible when he is highly motivated. That's the main point of this whole thing.
Eugene, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Eugene Kaplan is the author of Sensuous Seas, Tales of a Marine Biologist. He joined us today from his home on Long Island, New York. Don't go away. Our animal trivia question of the week is next with your chance to win a copy of Eugene's book. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
This is Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And before we go back to the phones, it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. And if you think you know the answer to this week's question, give us a call at this number, 1-800-462-7413. All correct guessers will have their names pulled together, and two winners will be selected at random to win a copy of Sensuous Seas by Eugene Kaplan. Here's today's question. Tilapia fish are a freshwater fish that inhabit shallow streams and large rivers, and when it comes to reproduction, the female tilapia lays a clutch of about 200 eggs. Upon fertilization, the eggs brood for about 1 to 2 weeks before hatching, and unlike birds who sit on their eggs while waiting for them to hatch, tilapia fish store their fertilized eggs in a certain part of the body. Where do female tilapia fish brood their eggs? If you know the answer, call us at 1-800-462-7413 and check out our website in about a week to find out the answer. We'll have it posted at callingallpets.org. And for now, we're ready to take some more calls, so let's do that. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi there, Larry and Patricia. My name is Pam, and I'm in Chesapeake, Virginia.
Pam, thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I have two family pets that I wanted to talk about. We have two dogs that are house pets. We have a boxer named Chloe and a half cocker spaniel named Sassy. And they've been with us a long time. They're about 12 and 13 years old. And that expression, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, we've found is not the case.
Good for you.
We've been working. My youngest son started working with the dogs one night, just kind of horsing around. And he's gotten them so that they will, to the response of a treat, they'll sit and they'll lay and they'll do the various things. But no extended period of time. And the funny thing is, the boxer especially, she thinks that she's employing mind control. She will rivet her eyes on the treat box, you know, trying to force you to open it up,
right,
and give her a treat. And then when you get them out in your hand, she rivets her attention to your hand, and on the command, she'll sit. But then when she gets her treat, she gets so excited that she jumps right up and, you know, wiggles all over and shakes and shimmies and just can't contain herself that she's going to get a treat. The cocker's a little different. She doesn't like to eat in front of you. So she sits to get her treat, but then she wants to take it away and hide to eat it.
Oh.
So I don't know how to get them to actually stay and be calm.
Gotcha.
After the, you know, after good, the initial.
Good questions. You know, so many books get you started and then sort of drop you.
Yeah.
Like, now what? Where's the intermediate dog training book, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, a couple of things. One is, please send me a plane ticket because I'm just dying to fly out and show you what I'll do. I'll do my best.
Boy.
I'll do my best with words on the radio. With a boxer who's riveted to these treats, we love that she loves food so much. That's wonderful. But yes, absolutely, you need to do two things, it sounds like. You need to wean her off of this laser-like focus
on
the food. And we also need to teach her that you need to lie down and stay for a certain amount of time.
Mm-hmm,
so those
mm-hmm.
are two separate things. One is, first of all, let's do the lie down and stay first.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Is one of the things about teaching a nice stay when a dog is lying down is to be sure when the dog is lying down, they're actually in a relaxed position rather than that sphinx-like, you know.
Yes.
Ready
right?
to leap.
And boxers
yes.
are famous for this, by the way. Yeah,
yes.
They just sort of flatten down and all the legs are just squished right underneath them. You know how when a dog is relaxed,
yes.
they flip their hips over?
Yes.
Well, that's what I want you to teach. You can teach that.
Okay.
And define that as being lie down.
Okay.
So when you say lie down and she does, what I want you to do is you're going to take the treat you still have in your hand, you put it right to her nose,
mm-hmm.
and then you're going to lure her nose around so that her nose is facing her tail.
Okay.
And what happens when you do that, if you do it just the right amount of speed, not too fast, not too slowly.
Her hip rolls.
Her hip rolls.
She'll roll, yeah.
And
yeah.
then you say, stay.
Okay.
And then stay, you have to go really slowly, step by step. So with your boxer, I would be sit, lie down, stay, good girl. And then I would move towards her with that little treat in my hand, a little tiny pea-sized wonderful piece of wonderfulness. And I would say, stay, and hold your left hand out like you're a traffic patrol person, and then move towards her with an underhanded move and give her a treat actually in her mouth. And then what I want is I want Chloe to get the treats for lying down, not for getting up.
I gotcha.
So, but what's probably going to happen is that while she's lying down and she gets a treat, she's going to think that means she can get up again. So that's going to be the tricky part to get over. Is this making sense?
Yes. No.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, it is.
Larry's nodding. So
good.
That's good. So what you're going to have to do is give her that treat while she's laying down, but then be ready for her to jump up. And what I want you to do is just pantomime with visual signals. No, that's not what I wanted. I want you to stay there. So you're just going to do your little hand signal for sit, hand signal for down, tap the ground again, put your hands out like a traffic cop again, and then pause. And if she just pauses for like 1 second, then you're going to say, okay, and let her up.
She will, you know, sometimes when I give the sit command, she'll look at my hand to see if I'm going to do this, the hand motion too. She's very, I mean, she's really smart.
Yeah, good.
She only wants to do exactly what she has to get that.
Right. And that's not atypical of a smart dog, right?
Yeah, right.
So
right.
One of the things to keep in mind is that dogs learn visual signals more easily than they actually learn to link a sound, a word, and an action. They primarily communicate visually. So do both. Say sit and then move your hand upward. Say down, move your hand downward. And you'll find that she'll learn the hand signals actually faster.
And what about the other dog that likes to, it was Sassy who likes to take her treat and then run off and somewhere else to eat it.
You might be giving her treats that are too big. Again, go to that pea-sized treat.
Okay.
A lot of relatively submissive dogs just want to go eat in private in case some other dog would steal the food or something like that. So who knows what's going on, but just give her a treat that's so tiny that she gulps it and it's gone.
And do that for a while?
And she'll stop doing it, especially if you give her a treat and then ask her to do something else right away and then give her another one. She'll learn to stick around.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And if you'd like to join in, the number to call is 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi there. This is Echo in Boise, Idaho.
Echo, pleasure to speak with you. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a 10-year-old German Shepherd, and he's always lived around other dogs. And here in the last 3 months, we have been living alone. And so when I'm at work all day, he has taken to barking all day. So I got a bark collar for him. And according to the neighbors, he hasn't been barking. But I feel really bad for him because I know he's just bummed out. And so I want to know what I can do for him so that he's not so bummed out.
Yeah, good for you. And I'm really glad you want to treat the problem and not the symptoms. Because the barking, as you know, as you said, is just a symptom. So it sounds like what a lot of people would call separation anxiety, where you have a dog who's used to being among others, and now for the first time in his life, he's living alone. It's like, you know, it's like some kids. They don't want to be alone. I went through a period when I was 5. I just never wanted to be alone. You know, got really clingy. So the good news is there's lots and lots you can do. And it sounds like if all that's happening is barking and he's not going through the window, so this sounds like a relatively moderate case. And so that's a really good thing. That makes me really happy. What I would start to do, I do a couple things. One is I would try that pheromone that we've talked about before, dog appeasing pheromone, DAP. It's a plug-in. You can use it as a plug-in anyway. Also, it comes in a collar now. But basically, it's a pheromone. You can't smell it, and dogs aren't even conscious necessarily of perceiving it, but it tends to have a soothing effect on some dogs. So that's certainly an easy thing to try, and I can't imagine where it would hurt anything.
Okay.
Another thing I try is start teaching him how fun it is when you leave, because when you leave, he gets, something wonderful. And the trick is not to, give him like a hollow toy stuffed with food, put it down and then leave for what people call a short time, like 10 minutes. That's actually not a short time if you're scared, right? If you're really, really scared, 10 minutes is a really, really long time. So the trick is to put this wonderful food down that he just loves and hard for him to get because it's inside something. So he has to work at it. You're going to walk out the door. You can turn around. You can come right back in again. You're going to take it away. Sometimes you can't even get to the door. Sometimes the dog gets nervous as you start to get ready. Maybe you're combing your hair in a way you only do when you're going to leave. You're getting your jacket. You get your keys. Figure out what the triggers are. And then link the triggers with something wonderful. So say it's your keys. You pick up your keys, he starts to pace. So pick up your keys, give him the stuffed food, the stuffed toy with great food inside. And then wait 5 seconds and then take it away. So he's like, well, I wasn't done. What are you doing? And then gradually you evolve that into going to the door, opening the door for 2 seconds, and then walking out of the door, and then leaving for a minute, and then for 5 minutes. And the best part of this story is, even though it takes patience and time to get started, you want to spend a couple of weeks with these very, very early steps. Once you have a dog who's okay alone for 5 minutes, it's easy to get to 15 minutes and then 60 minutes and then a couple hours, etc. So those are just two tips. There's some other things we can try if those don't work.
Good luck.
Yeah. Okay, that's great. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call.
All paws crossed.
All paws crossed. You know, we forgot to ask Eugene Kaplan about those turtles that were circling each other.
Yeah, we had an email about turtles who were circling around as if they were either doing a courtship display. Or we forgot. Well, I will check into this, I promise.
And we can also have people email in if they know the answer, too.
Maybe somebody knows why these turtles were circling and vibrating and quivering at each other. If you do, don't hesitate. Send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And thank you so much for listening today. Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director, and Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0216P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.